which of the two is authorized in the worship service. I really like the way that the next lesson is set up because it deals primarily with arguments that are often raised as to why instrumental music is authorized, according to some, in the worship service. And so there are others that as you go through that list of arguments that you could add to the list, but it's a good lesson and very well laid out to look at those various arguments. But when you think about the purpose of singing and why we have music in the worship anyway, what is the purpose of our singing?
To teach
each other. Yeah, to teach and admonish. To sing praise unto God. But as you look at those passages like Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15, that talks about in the midst of the assembly, will I sing praise unto thee? Acts 16:25, when Paul and Silas were in prison, the Bible says that at midnight they prayed and sang praises unto God. And teaching and admonishing one another, as you read about in Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16. If the purpose of music, one of the purposes is to teach and admonish one another, it makes it rather difficult to see then how that can be accomplished by the use of a mechanical instrument. Now that's very simple, but when you think about that, how does an instrument, a mechanical instrument of music like a piano or whatever the case may be, teach and admonish one another? How can you teach by use of a guitar? You can't. And so singing is to teach and admonish one another. It's to sing praise unto God. And certainly if singing is to sing praise unto God, how can you sing praise unto God by the use of a trumpet? Can you? No. You can play it, but that's completely different than singing. And so singing has at least a twofold purpose, to teach and admonish and then to sing praise unto God. Music in Christian worship, this is on page 104 at the top, is to instruct, communicate ideas from one to another and admonish those engaged in it to right living, in addition to being a medium of praise, thanksgiving, and supplication to God. And so there's a reason why we do what we do. We don't incorporate singing into our worship on the Lord's Day simply because we like it. Now, I'm encouraged by singing. It admonishes me. It encourages me. But that's not solely the reason as to why we do it. It's not part of the worship unto God because man saw fit to include it. Why is it a part of our worship to God? Because God commanded it. It's God that legislated, this is how I want to be worshipped. And it has never been left up to man to devise a way in which to worship God or to approach God in worship. It's always been the part of man to obey what God has said to do. And that's a point that we need to remember. And so that's the purpose of singing. The number three covers the manner of rendition, is the way that this is worded in your book. It's unto God. It's directed as praise unto God and not for simple entertainment. And we've made the statement several times before, we're not in the entertainment business, are we? But in the soul-saving business, in the worship business. And what we do in our worship is directed to who? To God. It's not directed to me, though I benefit from it. Though you sing to teach and admonish me and you, it's directed as praise unto God and not to man. A point is made whenever music in Christian worship degenerates or goes away from or into an effort to entertain, it becomes a stench in the nostrils of God. That's a strong statement, but you think about the many times, especially in the Old Testament, that the phrase is used that such and such was an abomination unto the Lord. That teaches you and it teaches me, God doesn't accept everything just simply because man gives it to God and man views it as something that is acceptable to God. We've got to remember that we're singing to please God, not the multitude. All that we do is not to please man, but is directed to God. And there are some passages that spell that out for us. If you have thoughts, comments on this, you feel free to say them as we go along. We're going to try to get through this lesson and into the next one tonight. When any act of worship is not directed to God, it misses its mark and is therefore vain. How do we know that God is the object of our worship? The Bible teaches, so we just, not too many lessons ago, talked about that. How that man is not to be worshipped. Remember when Peter went to the household of Cornelius? Cornelius did what? Fell down at his feet. And Peter took him up and said, I'm a man. So man is not to be worshipped. The devil's not to be worshipped. Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Matthew 4. In the book of Revelation, at least two times in the latter chapters, you have an instance where John fell at the feet of the angel that spoke those things, and he was told what? Get up. See thou do it not. Worship God. And so God is the object of our worship. It's interesting, too, that so many times individuals leave the worship service, and I've heard individuals make this remark about along through the years about worship. Well, I didn't get anything out of that. You heard that before? And attitudes like that suggest to us that they really miss the purpose of worship. Because our worship is not about what I get out of it, though we stand to benefit from it. We get instruction, we get encouragement and admonishment. But not so much that as what am I giving? What am I putting into it? I'm giving my worship to God. He's the object. He's our aim of our worship. How utterly abominable then is the attempt to attract the world by the music of the church. Let us be primarily concerned with causing God to listen. You think about what takes place in so many religious venues today and the music that is incorporated into those. Now granted, a lot of religious bodies will use hymns that even we sing without the accompaniment of an instrument. And they'll use those same hymns with the accompaniment of an instrument. But along the way, when the community church came on the scene, and when you begin to look at the music, what type of music is on display today?
Instrumental
music?
Temporary gospel.
What they call contemporary gospel. In fact, you might see some signs in front of buildings that say traditional service at 9, contemporary service at 10, or something along those lines. And really, that's an appeal to our younger generation. We're going to modernize it, including the song service, including the music. I don't know if you get DirecTV or Dish or might be on cable, but when you look at places like Hillsong services that come on, I mean, it's just like a rock concert. And the children are down there, and while typically in my younger days will be categorized as a mosh pit, they probably don't even call it that today, but jumping around and rushing around and hitting one another and bouncing off one another. And that's the same type of thing that you have incorporated into so-called Christian worship today. And yet all the while individuals think that because we like it, well, God must like it. Or simply because we're directing it to God, God is going to accept it. You think of some examples in the Bible where individuals directed something to God, but it was not acceptable to God. God is under no obligation to accept it because man simply renders it or serves it up to God. What are some examples of individuals who, though they were religious, though they were doing religious activities, though they were directing it to God, God did not accept it? Yeah. What happened with that, Wolf?
They
Okay.
They thought it would be acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, there was religious people, religious minded, engaged in religious activities, offering it up to the God of the Bible, right, to the God of Israel, and God didn't accept it.
And then early on, Cain, his sacrifice was not acceptable. It wasn't by faith. It wasn't by instruction. It was not accepted.
And I suppose we could have saved this for the next lesson, but I think that's a good way to deal with that. Is when you're talking with someone, what makes you believe? We can say it nicely and kindly, but what makes you believe that God accepts that? What? Why do you feel God accepts that?
It has to be written.
It has to be legislated, or else it's not in truth. And that's covered in our next lesson.
If you look at the world today, everybody thinks that God is love. That seems to be God's sense.
And it's just simply not the case. Our prayer, I think about Matthew 15:9. There's an example of individuals who were the text says that they were worshiping God. But it was what type of worship? Vain. But in vain they do worship me. They were worshiping Him. Religious minded people engaged in religious activities directed to God. But it was to no avail. And so we need to be primarily concerned with causing God to listen. What is pleasing to God? Searching it out in the Bible. B, in spirit, 1 Corinthians 14:15. Remember that I will sing with the spirit. I will sing with the understanding also. James 5:13. With the heart, Ephesians 5:19. With grace in your heart, Colossians 3:16. From this we learn that our hearts must accompany our singing and be thoroughly in accordance with the sentiment of the song being sung. In other words, it must be done in all sincerity. It's really easy, and all of us can relate to this, because it is easy to be so distracted from what we're doing, and yet all the while we're still engaged in singing. Some of us know these songs so well that we can be doing just about any number of things in the pews and not miss a word. I'm right there with you. But we need to be thinking about what we're doing. The heart is involved in it. Thinking about why we're doing this. It's directed to God. And so, feeling is not left out of the equation. The heart is not left out of it, because we need to be singing with the right spirit, the right attitude, the right understanding of what we're doing. These songs, as we've been engaged in our sermon and song series, have messages in them. Think about all the lessons you can learn from these many songs and these sermon and songs that we've been doing. We need to think about what we are saying. With the understanding, one can hardly sing sincerely what one does not understand. We need to study the sentiment expressed in the words of our songs, be sure that it is scriptural, and that we understand its meaning in order to be able to make that meaning and sentiment of our hearts. And not just assume, because it's included in a brotherhood hymnal, that every stanza is scriptural. I've read a lot of songs down through the years of which caused me to pause and to have second thought about. We just need to be careful and make sure that what we are singing is right. Can we sing the lie, by the way? Sure we can. We can sing a lie, something that's contrary to biblical truth. We can sing something that is contrary to our own actions. And when I think about that, I always think about, I want to be a worker for the Lord. Well, if I want to be a worker for the Lord, and I sing, I want to be a worker for the Lord. And are my actions in line with that?
You know, Paul in Titus, what was it, 1, quoting about that. Of not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men that turn from the truth.
Be truthful in what we are seeing. Not only in the truth, but in the spirit. So it's to be understood, speaking one to another, teaching and admonishing. There's nothing that I'm aware of, and if you found it, then you feel free to voice it, and I'll stand corrected. But there's nothing that comes to my mind in the New Testament or anywhere else where it's even hinted that God is after a correctly pitched hymn. Or they after four-part harmony. And it's okay to use that. I'm not saying that it's not. And I see the importance of pitching songs right. I'm not discrediting that. But sometimes we can put too much emphasis on some of the things that, and not enough emphasis on other things. Use soprano, tenor, alto, and bass. Go ahead and use it. But you don't have to. You don't have to be familiar with knowing how to do that. You just sing, make melody in your heart as to teach and admonish one another and direct that praise unto God and do the best job that you can. And if we do that, then God will be pleased. This divine purpose for singing is entirely lost unless the words are scriptural and sentiment and pronounced plainly enough to be understood by the audience. The teaching to be done in singing must be by the words of the song, since the tune or melody cannot teach anyone anything. Are you admonished by the tune or by the words? It's a point that's being made. And I like listening to well-sung hymns. You? The greater importance is the fact that we are doing the best of our ability to sing truthful songs directed to God. The kind of songs to be used is as important as doing our best in singing them. And we do need to do the best job that we can in our song service. We do need to put our best foot forward in every aspect of our worship to God. I think we all understand that and would agree with that. But the kind of song is equally as important as to doing our best job in the way that we sing the hymns. Some songs are not always appropriate at all times. You think about that. Some of the songs in our book are not written for particular occasions. I don't care that much particularly about the song, "Oh, Why Not Tonight," being sung as an invitational hymn in the morning to suggest to someone to wait till tonight. Right? I'm not saying that's wrong to do that, but I'm just saying that think about the appropriateness of some of the songs. Psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, and I didn't say anyone did that, so if you did, I won't direct that at you. Psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16. And I'll tell you that in a lot of religious venues, those are not the types of songs being used today. A lot of the songs that are being used, though they use the word Jesus many times, are not spiritual songs in their nature. Psalms and hymns. What's a psalm? Okay. It's a song that is spiritual in its nature. People have an example of 150 of them in the Old Testament. But when you begin to think about the purpose of those songs, there's several different types of psalms, thanksgiving psalms and praise psalms, messianic psalms, and on and on and on, lamenting psalms. Psalms and hymns appear to have been used interchangeably, not only convey the character in general of the songs to be sung, but specify in particular what such compositions are to be spiritual. When you think about the types of songs that we sing today, are they spiritual in nature? Well, they are. They have a lesson. Many times we sing about heaven. Many times we sing about evangelism. Many times we sing about Jesus, about the cross, about salvation, about redemption, about one another, about praying, and about God. There's just a list of the types of songs that are spiritual in their nature with a spiritual meaning. Well, he makes a point here that that could scarcely be descriptive of the Star-Spangled Banner, Yankee Doodle, or I Washed My Hands This Morning. Neither could any of the light, trivial, jiggy tunes used today be classified as spiritual. It does matter what kind of song we use in our worship service. And I'm thankful for books that are compiled for us to sing. Now, you think we have a large selection, 600 some hymns to choose from in this hymnal? And what if we didn't have that? If we had five songs and we sung the same five songs, people might tire of that, but is it getting the job done? Questions? How many kinds of music are there? Two. Read, and this wasn't a question, but just kind of a sign for you. Read and note carefully the quotations on the music as used in the New Testament. We've done that several times since I've been here over the past almost 5 years. Remember that chart, sing or play? I've handed that out to you. We've talked about it. We've done lessons and Bible studies using it. In every one of those, what is the music that is used? Every New Testament example. That's right. Singing, the voice. Is the teaching of the New Testament complete on this matter?
Yes.
Yes. Specify the purpose of singing. Sing praise unto God, teach, admonish. Is the mission of singing to entertain?
No.
Is the singing to be directed to please men? When we have an annual singing, I think you guys have done a good job on that last couple of years. But even when we do that, that's not to get people in here to impress them with what we can do. It's to have an opportunity to spend time singing praise unto He who created us and teach and admonish one another. Is singing that is acceptably done directed primarily to the listener? No, it's primarily directed to God. What is the idea expressed with the Spirit and with understanding? Read it right out of your book if you want to.
Is it understand what words you're speaking and do it with the heart?
Good. Sincerity with the heart. Understanding. What kinds of songs are to be used in worship? Good job. What is wrong with using, interesting on how you responded to this, what is wrong with using semi-spiritual songs? What did you put in that blank?
Semi-right and semi-wrong.
Okay. Okay. Semi-spiritual gives the idea that it's not spiritual, right? Just part something, which means it's not. Yeah. Good. Has God specified the kind of music we are to use, or has it been left up to our judgment? Specified. I think we talked about that last week, that even in the Old Testament, it was never left up to the judgment of man. Even when mechanical instrumental music was part of the worship unto God, it was never left unto man, take or leave. It's okay if you do, it's okay if you don't. Either way. Never has that been the case that I'm aware of. You. It gets us to lesson 39. on instrumental music. And this is a lesson, as I stated at the beginning of the lesson tonight, that deals specifically with instrumental music and the various arguments. And some of you know the arguments that are made better than I do. I can deal with them better than I can deal with them. But I like this because these are ones that, as I was reading through it and preparing for the study, that I've heard. I've heard people make these arguments. Someone read for us the introduction and then under the title, The Argument That Has Never Been Made.
Examine some of the most commonly used contentions in favor of mechanical instruments being added to the music of the Christian church. The argument has never been made. No one has ever yet contended or argued that instrumental music should be added to the worship because of the New Testament scriptures, as we have them given to us today by the good providence of God, teach that it should be used. Not one passage has ever been produced which even indirectly mentions the mechanical instruments of music. Being unable to make this contention, those who use instrumental music have been forced to depend its use upon other grounds. The following arguments are made.
Did you ever think about it from that standpoint? The argument that has never been made? You've talked to individuals, and I have too, and we've listened to the arguments, and we've tried the best we can to deal with them. But I've never had the argument made, let's use them because the New Testament says we need to use them. Have you? Argument that has never been made. Maybe it's been made to you, I don't know, but I've never heard it. So I thought that was a good observation. That when we think about, and listen, the ones that I've talked to, and we look at it and we take for granted so many times because we understand the divisions of the Bible, we understand the authority that we're under today, the New Testament. Not everyone believes that. Not everyone believes that we are solely under the authority of just the New Testament Scriptures. And even at that, not everyone believes in the idea which we talk about so often, about how to establish biblical authority by direct statement, necessary inference, or an approved apostolic example. Not everyone believes that. And so as a result of that, they say, well, that's just man-made. That's something that you've came up with. And so they make their appeal to other things, whether it's the Old Testament Scriptures or show me a reference where the disciples in the New Testament ever stopped using it. And the list goes on. Here's the first argument that is dealt with in your book. And we're not going to get through many of these because we only have 5 minutes left. But it was practiced under the law of Moses in Old Testament times. That's probably the most common argument that folks use. I don't know how many times individuals have made that argument with me and would go directly to Psalm 150. Because Psalm 150 is just chock full of the use of mechanical instruments of music. Cymbals. So, I mean, he lists several of them in that psalm. But it's by way of being able to deal with this, the same argument would introduce incense, infant church membership. Now, how would that be allowed? You might have stopped at that and thought, how does that have anything to do with the Old Testament? How would it was practiced under the law of Moses authorize also infant church membership? Circumcision, which was a sign that they were a Jew in covenant relationship with God by the very fact, the nature of their birth into a particular family. They were within the family of God by nature of that physical birth. So I think that's what he's after in this first point. But I would say that animal sacrifices, polygamy, and everything else that characterized the Old Testament period. And he says that which proves much proves nothing. And so when you think about just the argument, well, it was done and practiced under the Old Testament law of Moses, well, that would open up the floodgates for a host of other things that you would never be able to get out. And how do you reason away incense burning? How do you reason away, based on the same argument, animal sacrifices? I mean, you can't use the argument, well, just the Ten Commandments is what was binding and carried over, because mechanical instruments of music was nowhere stated in the Ten Commandments. So that won't work. But then B, to practice anything taught by Moses but not taught by that should be violent strength. Christ is fatal in Christianity because it places the authority of Moses on a par with the authority of Christ. And we know what the Bible says about the law of Moses versus the law of Christ. Romans chapter 7, 1 through 4. To undertake to live under both the law of Moses and under the law of Christ is spiritual adultery. Remember when we talked about that in Romans 7, 1 through 4? Relative to the wife and her husband. To justify what we do by the law of Moses is to save ourselves from Christ and fall from grace. It was a strong statement and argument that Paul used in Galatians 5, 4. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, you're falling from grace. If your worship is justified by what the Old Testament scriptures say, then you're not under grace. You've fallen from it. And
we have to be dead to the law now?
That's right. And become dead to the law by the body of Christ. That's what that passage talks about in Romans 7. To go back to the law of Moses for some practice not taught by Christ and the apostles is to deny the all-sufficiency of New Testament scriptures and disrespect the completeness of Christ's authority. We'll finish 4 and 5. When you think about that, if you sit down with, and you know the passage as well as anyone else, Matthew 17, 5, "This my beloved Son, whom I'm well pleased, hear ye Him." If you sit down and just take the New Testament, which is what we are under today, Galatians 6, 2, and 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 21, talks about being under the law of Christ. And you look at just what the New Testament says by it, concerning it, not one time again is instruments of music authorized or even discussed in the church. To depend upon Old Testament authority for Christian practice is to I don't think that's the right word. I think that's probably it. Resurrect an invalid law. Okay, I understand. An invalid law and deny the effectiveness of Christ's death upon the cross. The Old Testament law has been done away with, and we try to be that which has been put out of the way to resurrect it and live by it. Colossians 2:14. To depend upon the old law is to cling to the shadow and lose the substance. Hebrews 10 and in verse 1. The things we've talked about are just so simple statements and simple principles that if we respect the authority of Christ as revealed in the New Testament, we have no reason whatsoever to not see the things that we have talked about. Our time has come and gone. Any thoughts, questions? We'll stop there, and then Lord willing, next Wednesday we'll begin with number 2. That'll give you a time, if you haven't done so already, to go through this lesson and get your questions prepared. I appreciate your good attention.